Welcome everyone to our class this evening. Our brother Evan's here again to continue his studies on Samson, part three this evening. Now, is this the final part or have you got more
Sunday.
Parts for next year?
Sunday
morning, excellent. Thank you. So to form as an introduction to our brother Evan's study this evening, we'll be taking a reading from Judges chapter 16, verses 1 to 22. And it's the story of Samson and Delilah. Okay, with that, we'll ask Evan to come forward and continue his study on Samson. And tonight's theme is Samson, the weak man of Israel. Thanks, Evan.
All right. So, last class, we left Samson on a bit of a spiritual high, didn't we? Remember, he just got up the top of that mountain and he chucked the jawbone of the ass off. And it was the first time in the whole record that Samson's actually spoken to God. You would think, Samson being one of the judges and a spiritual guy and a faithful guy, that he would have had a relationship with God. But we'd seen over the last few weeks that he actually didn't. He didn't have a relationship with God until the end of chapter 15. So I've gone through chapter 13, 14, and 15 has not spoken to God once in that time. And then, the end of chapter 15, he finally speaks to God. And the old Samson has disappeared. So we could say he's put off the old man, as it were, to use the words of the Apostle Paul. He's by no means perfect, and we'll see that tonight, but he's started a journey, which is important. And it's important for us to see that. Because sometimes we can be very critical of Samson. We can be very critical. Because we have so many of his faults actually just detailed to us. But you know what? If we were to have our own lives put under the spotlight and only four events, negative events, were focused on or recorded, I reckon we'd be in a fairly similar situation to Samson. We could not be happy with what we saw, particularly if it's the same things that are having the spotlight brought on us that are stupid and we keep on doing them. That's what Samson was doing. Well, that's the record that we have of him. So we wouldn't see Samson in a faithful light if we didn't have passages like the end of chapter 15 or even the end of chapter 16, which we'll look at on Sunday. And if we didn't have those and we only had Hebrews chapter 12, we'd sort of question, why is he in Hebrews, not chapter 12, chapter 11? You know what? Let's go to Hebrews 11. Let's have a quick start there. Because I think that the writer of the Hebrews, whoever that was, could be Paul, could be someone else, actually had Samson in mind. Not just in verse 32 of Hebrews 11, but in a couple of verses afterwards. Let me explain. Hebrews 11, verse 32, it actually specifically mentions Samson. But then it goes on and talks about some other people. So, and what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, of Barak, of Samson and Jephthah, of David and Samuel, and of the prophets, who, just see if we can see Samson in these, subdued kingdoms, I don't know if we can see that, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, that's obviously Daniel, right? Quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness was made strong. Interesting. Waxed valiant in flight, turned to flight the armies of the alien. I actually think that whoever wrote Hebrews actually had Samson in mind when he used those words, the weak were made strong. Because not just when he was in the temple of Dagon and he's got his hands on the posts and he's weak at that point, God's left him. And then God comes back to him. And he's strong enough to force the building down. And that's being weak, being made strong. But it's more than that. Samson's spiritual weakness was actually made into a strength. He was weak morally, but made strong spiritually. And God willing, that's what we'll see on Sunday. Okay. God was the one that made Samson strong. Physically strong, but we'll see that he made him spiritually strong as well. Okay, hopefully that's what we'll see tonight as well. Now, I'm only going to go up to verse 22, because that's all we read. But in this chapter, you can break it up into three distinct portions. So the first part, I think we can break it up to be verse 1 to 3. So if you're writing notes or you're putting things in your margin, I like to do that. Verse 1 to 3 is dealing with the harlot in Gaza and taking the gates of the city of Gaza all the way up to the top of the hill. So that's the first part. Then it deals specifically with his relationship with Delilah. So that goes up to verse, I think, 22 or 23. And then from there to the end is all that contest with Yahweh versus Dagon in the Temple of Dagon. What's interesting, though, we don't actually have a sequence of events, like in terms of we don't know how close the first three verses was to the rest of it. Obviously, the last part, like with the situation with Delilah, and then he's captured, and then he's gone to the Temple of Dagon, that's all one sort of narrative. We don't know exactly how long he was in the mill grinding, but it doesn't seem like it was overly long. It would have been a significant amount of time, but not a huge amount of time. But from that event, all the way back to verse 1 to 3, we don't actually know how long before that actually was. It might have been close. It might have been somewhere in the middle of the 20 years that he actually judged Israel. We don't know. All we do know is he judged Israel for 20 years, starting from the end of chapter 15. Then verse 1 to 3 happens somewhere in there, and then the situation with Delilah right at the end of that 20 years. So what we're going to do, we're going to start specifically now just looking at this first three verses, just with this situation in Gaza. So let's pick it up, verse 1. Then went Samson to Gaza and saw there an harlot and went in unto her. And it was said to the Gazites, Samson's come hither. And they compassed him in and laid wait for him all night in the city, in the gate of the city, and were quiet all the night, saying, in the morning, when it's day, we'll kill him. And Samson lay until midnight and arose at midnight and took the doors of the gate of the city and the two posts and went with them, bar and all, and put them on his shoulders and carried them all the way up to the top of a hill that is before Hebron. Why was Samson in Gaza? Why? Why did he go to Gaza? Was it the same reason he was going to Timnath to be part of the Philistines? I don't think so. I think there's an element of it because he went down to Timnath, I think, for inheritance. But I actually think the same reason is why he went down to Gaza. Because Gaza was actually encompassed in that land that was actually given to Judah. And he saw that and he thought, you know what? These guys, these Philistines, the head of the Philistines, they are in the land of Judah, occupying that city, and they shouldn't be. So I think he went down there to say, no, this is Israel's inheritance. So I don't think he was going down there specifically to be part of the Philistines, because that's the old Samson. That was the Samson that was done away with. Now he sees the Philistines for what they are, and he wants to actually say, no, this is Israel's, and specifically Judah's, inheritance. And the inheritance is something that comes up time and time and time again in Samson's life. Let's have a look at this. Chapter 13, verses 25 to 14, verse 1. What's it say? I'll have to go back a bit. Chapter 13, verse 25. He's gone down, the Spirit of Yahweh began to move him at times between the camp of Zorah and Eshtaol. And he went down to Timnath and saw a daughter of the women of Timnath, the daughters of the Philistines. He's gone down there. Timnath means inheritance. And he's gone down there with the intention of taking inheritance. And we had a decent look at that in our first class. The parable of the lion in chapter 14 is really, while it's a miraculous event, while it's an interesting thing to look at, and there were lots of lessons that we can learn from that, if we were to analyse that a little bit closer, which we didn't actually do in that class, we'd actually see that the lion is a parable of Israel. In fact, the words that are used of the Philistines coming and crying against Israel, or crying against Samson, is the same words that's actually used of a lion roaring. So it's like Samson's grabbed this roaring lion of the Philistines and ripped it apart, destroyed it, and out of it comes honey, like a land flowing with milk and honey. So I've got another link to inheritance with that. Then at the very end of chapter 16, you know what his brethren do? They actually take Samson's body from the temple of Dagon down with the Philistines and bring it to his own inheritance, his own family, personal inheritance. And I think that's what is something that characterises Samson's life, is this idea of inheritance. In fact, that word, the sepulchre where he's buried, same words that's used of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, specifically in relation to inheritance. So, when we come to chapter 16, verse 1 to 3, this is a theme that comes up again. So it's come up a number of times, and now it's coming up again. But he sees these guys for what they are. Now, what we want to do is we want to actually put a note in our margin to go to Genesis chapter 22. Because this, I think, when Samson went down to Gaza, this is where his mind is. Genesis chapter 22. Remembering, he's taken the gates of the city and he's going up to Hebron. And he's talking about possessing those gates. So Genesis chapter 22, verse 17. By the way, know how big these gates actually are? This is a huge feat of strength. Before we get to Genesis 22, how heavy do you reckon they are, Joel? I actually have somewhere between 2.5 to 5 tonne. 3's good. Well done. So let's say it's 3 tonne. Now, can you lift 3 tonne, Josh?
No.
Yeah, I'm strong. He went that away. Is that what you're... Okay. No, you can't. It's a lot of weight. Right? You can do it in little bits. Right? A kilo here and a kilo there. You can eventually lift 3 tonne. No, he did it all on his back, on his shoulders. And he ripped these gates. This is all from excavations at the time. They say the big, thick, walled gates. And he sticks them on his shoulder, which is huge. And then he doesn't just walk them from here to the city. He walks them about 50 kilometres, roughly. So here up to Mount Barker, or further, probably Murray Bridge. But it's uphill the whole time. How high is Mount Lofty? It's about 300 metres. Am I being too generous?
700 feet.
Mount Lofty is 700 metres. Mm. Is it really? Yeah. Well, this is higher than Mount Lofty. I thought it was only about half that. There you go, 700 metres. So he's gone the distance to Murray Bridge, and he's gone up a kilometre in elevation. Because that hill that he's talking about is about a kilometre high. Now that's pretty decent. Now let's imagine that he left at midnight and he gets there by about 7 a.m. roughly. It's like he's actually doing it a little under a jog with 3 tonne on his back at the same time, uphill. Now I can't do that. Josh might, but not likely. Okay, so he's done that. But while he's doing that, his mind is occupied by something. We're going to see what it is. Genesis 22, verse 17. Now, what happened in Genesis 22? Yeah.
3 tonne is about the weight of a white rhinoceros. Just for
a white rhinoceros. That's a big animal.
Or a baby blue whale.
Or 333 cases of beer.
Sorry. That's right. It's 3,000 bottles of wine. That's a lot of... anyway, he goes up the hill and he's got this in his mind at the same time. Now, Genesis 22, what's it about? Which one?
The one with the stars and the sand.
Yeah. What happens before? Isaac is
asleep.
Not sacrificed. He didn't get sacrificed. Boy. What Bible are you reading? No, it's not that one. He almost was, and the angel comes and says, no, stop, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And then he gets some promises. Let's have a look at these promises. Okay, verse 17. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, I'm in the wrong chapter. He didn't say that. I'm in the wrong chapter. Chapter 22, verse 17, he gives the promises that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed, which is interesting, as the stars of the heaven and as the sand of the sea which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. And thy seed in thy seed shall all nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned unto his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt at Beersheba. Now, what did it say? It said, yes, the stars of the heaven, the sand of the seashore, and will possess the gate of his enemies. What's Samson done? He has literally picked up the gates of Gaza from the Philistines, his enemies, stuck them on his back, and walked uphill to Hebron. Come back now to Genesis chapter 13. Some more promises. Genesis chapter 13, verse 14. The Lord said unto Abraham, after Lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes and look from the place where thou art, north, south, east, and west. For all the land, interesting, inheritance, all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. And I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth, so that a man can number the dust of the earth. Then shall thy seed also be numbered. So there's clear links to Genesis 22. Arise, walk through the land in the length of it and the breadth of it, for I will give it to thee. This is about inheritance, the inheritance of the land. And from that point, Abraham would be able to see north, south, east, and west. Samson as well, at the top of this 1 kilometre high hill, can see north, south, east, and west. And it's like he's acting out these promises. That's where his mind is. But there's more. Because why does he go to Hebron? Why doesn't he choose some other city to go or some other hill to go to? He goes to Hebron. Why? For this reason. Let's just read on one more verse. Then Abraham removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which coincidentally means strength, which is in Hebron. And in Hebron, he built an altar to Yahweh. That is exactly what Samson was thinking when he was taking that gate up the hill. So taking those gates up the hill to Hebron really implies that his mind was firmly fixed on the promises. And seeing that God was the one that gave him the strength to do that. So, I actually think that that was one of the pinnacles of faith of Samson in the whole record. More so than the last chapter. Not as much, I think, as the end of the next chapter. So going to that Hebron, that hill in Hebron, he can actually look around north, south, east, and west and see all of that. He's seeing the gates of his enemies literally possessed. And he's there on that hill near where Abraham made an altar after those promises were made. So, Samson goes... So I've got a slide on that. I'm hopeless with slides. Absolutely hopeless with... Gaza, by the way, also means strength. Just in case you hadn't seen it there. Okay. Now, he goes down to Gaza, and even though Samson had those ideas in his mind, and even though he was focused on the inheritance and focused on the promises, he gets distracted. as is his tendency to do. And how often does that happen? How often does that actually happen to us? That we can be all fervent for the truth, we can go to the Bible class, we can go to the meetings, we can be heavily involved in the ecclesia, but every single one of us sin. Every single one of us have temptations, whatever they may be. Samson's was women. Ours may not be. Ours may be, I don't know, gambling. Ours may be getting angry. It might be pride. Whatever our temptation is, we all fall into it. But Samson had that as the issue that he was being affected by. And just like it was with the woman of Timnath, he falls into the same problem. He goes after her because of his eyes. He sees her there and he goes after her because of his eyes. It would be remiss, I think, of us to not focus on the last aspect of this. It's definitely there, and it's something that Samson was blinded by. And to go into the harlot, he should not have done it. It is not okay on any level. But for us to just focus on that for us in particular, I think we need to take it a little bit broader, even though that is definitely a context in which this applies. Now, as we go through some of these chapters or these passages that we're going to look at in a moment, yes, there's a definite connection with lust. That's unmistakable. And that's a very relevant thing for us to consider. But what if we're not so much affected by that? We're all affected by temptation, and so we need to see this as sin as a whole rather than just one thing, which is certainly applicable as well. So what I want to do, let's go to Proverbs chapter 7. And in Proverbs chapter 7, it's talking about a young man. Samson is somewhere between, say, 20 and 40 years old, somewhere within there. So a young man, and it's a man who's void of understanding, to use the words of the proverb. Void of understanding, and he goes into these dodgy areas of town, like Gaza. That's a dodgy area of town. And surprise, surprise, while he's there, he meets a woman, an adulterous woman, a harlot. And so there's some very clear parallels between Proverbs chapter 7 and Samson's situation. Very clear. Verse 6. For at the window of my house I looked through my casement and beheld among the simple ones, I discerned among the youths a young man void of understanding. We could call him Samson. Passing through the street near her corner. And he went the way to her house. In the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And behold, there met him a woman with the attire of a harlot, subtle of heart. And at that point, Samson's distracted. I went down to Gaza with the best of intentions, but like all of us, even with the best of intentions, he falls away and he strays. And he was with her until midnight. And we know it was exactly midnight when he left. He was with her until midnight. Verse 18, she goes through and says a whole heap of things like, come in to me, and entices him in. Like sin entices us, whatever that enticement might be for us personally. And she says in verse 18, come, let us take our fill of love until the morning and solace ourselves with loves. She says, no, come in. And he does. Samson didn't go to Gaza with that intention. He didn't go there with the purpose of going into her. But he ends up being tempted and he was distracted. And so in this scene, we have what's very similar to what Samson is actually going through in Judges chapter 16. But the important part for us is what happens towards the end. Verse 24. Hearken unto me, therefore, O ye children. This is the lesson. Hearken unto me,
and attend to the words of my mouth. Let not thine heart decline to her ways. Go not astray in her paths. For she's cast down many wounded. Yea, many strong men have been slain by her. Let's just read that again. She's cast down many wounded. Yet many strong men like Samson have been slain by her. Her house is the way to hell, going down to the chambers of death. And so the lesson for us, don't even go there. That's the lesson. Don't even go there. Her paths were in the dodgy area of town. Her paths, that means the road trodden, were the ways of sin. Her paths were the paths that lead to death. Now there's the obvious application of this to lust, but there's also application to whatever, because it's symbolic of sin, whatever our temptations personally might be. So if we know we've got a problem in a certain area, like Samson, what are we doing? Do we go down to that dodgy area of town? There's no problem with walking past a corner. There's no problem if you do a certain thing. Like there's what's the Apostle Paul say? He says, I can do all things, but not all things are expedient. No problem with walking past a corner. But Samson knew that he had a problem there and still goes there. It's like he's flirting with temptation. So now I'll be right. Well, you know what? You're not. Samson, you're not okay. Samson has a tendency to get closer and closer and closer to a problem. So he goes down past that harlot's house. Later in the chapter, what does he do with Delilah? With the hare, when she keeps on pestering him? She says a few things to him. We'll have a look at this a bit more in a moment. But he says, oh, if you tie me with seven green withes, seven. He had seven locks of hair. Oh, if you have new ropes and bind me. His hair looked like ropes. It was huge dreadlocks, like that thick. Then he goes even more specific and he says, oh, if you put my hair in the loom. Well, he's getting closer and closer and closer. And then he finally tells her about the Nazarite vow. So it's almost like he's wanting to get really close to, as close to sin as he possibly can without actually committing it. But he finds himself in all sorts of trouble. Let's go to James chapter 1. James 1. Now we know what this is about. This is about temptation after it talks about trial. James 1 verse 13. Let no man say when he's tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempts he any man. But every man is tempted when he's drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust is conceived, it brings forth sin, and sin, when it's finished, brings forth death. So the first thing we see, what James is saying, is that God doesn't tempt us. We tempt ourselves, and our temptation actually comes from within us. We are the ones that are responsible for it. And it says that we're drawn away by this. We are drawn away by that temptation. It's like you want to do the right thing, but our lusts and our biases are working against us. We want to do the right thing, but sin is always present with me, as the Apostle Paul says, pulling you away from doing what's right. Paul says, the good that I would, I do not. And the evil that I would not, that I do. Bit of a tongue twister. It means I want to do the right thing, but I just find that I'm always tempted to do the wrong things. A law within my members that tells me to do the wrong thing. And we're enticed, drawn away by it, enticed in verse 14. It just means we're trapped. We're trapped by that. And it links in fairly closely, if you've got a reference in your margin, to Proverbs chapter 7. There's a verse in there. I think it says the guy was like a bird caught in a snare, trapped. And so we've got that situation. And what we do, whatever our temptations might be, we're dragged away from it. We're dragged away by it, by the enticing nature of sin. Take little nibbles here, little nibbles there. But before you know it, you're trapped. You're enticed. And James is saying, we are the ones responsible for that. God's not responsible for that. We are. The temptation comes from within. And so if that's the cause, what are we doing about it? What are we doing about it? Samson saw a woman in Timnath. What did he do about it? He saw an harlot. What did he do about it? He loved Delilah. What did he do about it? Nothing. His issue was his eyes, and what he was looking at. What did God do to Samson towards the end of his life? Made him blind. Plucked him out. So for us, what are we doing about those things that tempt us? What are we doing about lust in our own lives? What do we do with our phones? What do we do about where the computers are located in our house? What do we do if we're alone with our boyfriend or our girlfriend? Or if it's pride? What do we do when we're putting, do we put ourselves in positions at work or in the ecclesia where we can find ourselves being puffed up if we've got a problem in that area? Or what if it's gossip? What if it's anger? What if it's negativity? What do we do? What do we talk about in our families? Do we talk about, oh, this brother or that sister? Do we talk about this family member, that family member in a way that's like really negative? What do we do? And what do we do about changing that? Do we put ourselves in those positions if we know we've got a problem and take little nibbles here and there? If that's what we're doing, then before we know it, like the Apostle James says, is, well, we're trapped. We're enticed. We're drawn away. And we fall into that position of sin. Samson did nothing about it. And so eventually God had to do it for him. Okay, so that's the first three verses. And we've got about 15 minutes to go. Judges chapter 16, let's pick up the passage about Delilah, verse 4. It came to pass afterwards that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. Well, like a dog to its vomit, he goes back, hasn't learned at all. His relationship with Delilah is actually quite different to the others. This is the only woman that it actually says that he loved, which is interesting because he married the first one. But she seems to be the preeminent woman in his life. And I think it's important probably just to note, they weren't married. We have no record of that whatsoever. So for Samson to be going into her and whatever, that's not okay. That's not okay. It's thought, we can't prove this, I can't be dogmatic about it. Delilah was probably Jewish. I always thought of her as like a Philistine. There's a few things in there that actually indicate to us she was probably Jewish. Number one, Samson's actually turned away from the Philistines, wants nothing to do with them. Number two, her name is actually of Semitic origin, so Delilah is like a Jewish name. Number three, she lives in Sorek, which is literally like the next town away from the camp of Dan where he was. So it's highly likely, and there's a couple of other things as well. She doesn't call the Philistines my people, like his wife did. She calls them the Philistines. So it's like there's a separation there. So she's most likely Jewish, can't prove it, so I'm not going to be dogmatic about that. But if that's the case, it does give a few, I don't know, maybe a little bit more insight into what Solomon says in Proverbs chapter 2. It's just like a reverse. We'll go to Proverbs chapter 2. It's like a reverse reference. So just as an interest point. Proverbs chapter 2. Verse 16. We won't spend long in this. So Solomon's talking about this woman. That here, we'll just read it. to deliver thee from the strange woman, like Delilah, even from the stranger which flatters with her words, which forsakes the guide of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. I think that's the epitome of Delilah. If she's Jewish, she's forgotten the covenant of her God. For her house inclines unto death, and her paths unto the dead. None that go into her return again, like Samson, neither take they hold on the paths of life, as God has left them. That thou mayest walk in the way of good men, and keep the paths of the righteous. For the upright shall dwell in the land, like inheritance, again a reference to Samson, and the perfect man shall remain in it. But the wicked shall be cut off from the earth, and transgressors shall be rooted out. Now, I'm not going to go into much of that, but there's actually quite a few references back to that, back to Samson from that. So back to Judges. Told you we weren't going to spend long there. So I've got this situation where we've got this situation where Delilah has actually stabbed him in the back. And she's trying to get out of him on the behest of the five lords of the Philistines, his secret to his strength. And what they do is they actually give to Delilah the promise that if you can hand Samson over to us, we are going to make you wealthy. Not just a little bit wealthy, vastly wealthy. In fact, you could retire comfortably. They say to her, we will give you 1,100 shekels each. So 1,100 times 5. So 5,500 shekels. Now, that is the equivalent of about, 1,100 shekels is the equivalent of about $10 million. So we're talking about times five, 50 mil. Now, if your husband or wife or your boyfriend or girlfriend was offered $50 million to hand you over to the Philistines, would you do it? The correct answer is no. I asked Kate. I did. This is going back a few years. You might not remember. I remember it distinctly. She hesitated. But the right answer came out, thankfully. That's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. So when we say retire, she could retire very, very comfortably. I'd always thought that Delilah was a bit like Jezebel, like this epitome of evil, but that's a lot of money. And so you can understand why that temptation would be there. It's not just like, oh, she's just flippantly saying, oh, Samson, I'll hand you over to the Philistines because they don't like you. No, I think there was a relationship there, but that's a lot of money. Don't get me wrong, Delilah was wrong. She was absolutely wrong. But we'll come to that. Verse 6. Delilah said to Samson, tell me, I pray thee, wherein thy great strength lies, and wherewith mightest thou be bound to afflict thee? And Samson said unto her, if they bind me with 7 green withes that were never dried, then shall I be weak and be as other men. And I've lost my place. Verse 8, then the lords of the Philistines brought up to her 7 green withes which had not been dried, and she bound him with them. Now there were men lying in wait, abiding with her in the chamber, and she said unto him, the Philistines be upon thee, Samson. He broke the withes with as a thread of tow is broken when it touches the fire. So his strength was not known. Now these verses, actually, they follow a similar sort of pattern. But when we look at them sort of a bit analytically, I suppose, we can see what's actually going on here. So if we look at the first scene that we just read, we can actually see it's these green withes, right? Or it's like bowstrings. They're in the chamber. the Philistines are in the chamber. They're with Delilah there, with bated breath, hiding in the cupboard, waiting for it to all unfold. Samson's now weak. We're going to jump out and pounce and grab him. So they're there. They're in the chamber. The next scene, we actually see them in the house. The third scene, they're not even there. The fourth one, Delilah actually has to go and get them. So it's almost like, right at the start, oh, they're keen to get Samson, but gradually they start backing away and start losing interest. What about Delilah, though? When she starts off, she's in there with him, obviously, but she repeats verbatim what the Philistines actually said for her to say. So it's almost like, yep, I know what I've got to do. I'm a bit nervous. But as the Philistines are losing interest, Delilah's gaining confidence. Maybe she's getting to the point, oh, I've got 50 mil on the line here. What am I going to do? Am I actually going to get this? And so she starts getting more confident. We see she repeats the words of the Philistines. In the second scene, she accuses Samson of telling her lies. And then she stands boldly against, tell me, Samson, tell me, what's the source of your strength? And then she's honoured him. We don't know how many times, but it seems like it's a lot after the third time. On and on and on at Samson, repeatedly asking him. And then Samson gives in. We also see with Samson, like we mentioned just before, he's also getting closer to sin each time. So as the Philistines are losing confidence, Delilah's gaining confidence, and Samson at the same time is getting closer and closer to telling her what his source of strength actually was and handing himself over to the Philistines. She just kept on at him like a bit of a drip. And then he totally sells out. Verse 16. And it came to pass when she pressed him daily with her words and urged him so that his soul was vexed unto death. So it must have been a fair while, and she must have been fairly persistent, that he told her all his heart. And he said unto her, there has not come a razor upon mine head, for I have been a Nazarite unto God from my mother's womb. If I be shaven, then my strength will go from me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man. He gives in. He gives in. And this was a tragedy. Because at this point, Samson, because of Delilah's nagging, has now turned his back on God. It's like someone who's come into the truth and has left. And it's terrible. And it seems like he's reluctantly said goodbye. But said goodbye nonetheless. And that's something, I think there's a lesson in that. You know, the Apostle Paul talks about not being unequally yoked. And that's we do relate that to the marriage relationship, and it can be related to any sort of relationship, not being unequally yoked. But there's reality in that. And if there's a constant tugging away from the truth, is very hard and would take a very, very strong person indeed to combat that. Yeah, there's situations where that has happened. But it would take a very strong person to do that. So Samson sells out. And God has left Samson. He's left Samson. Verse 18. And when Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, come up this once, for he has showed me all his heart. And the lords of the Philistines came up unto her, and brought money in their hand. And she made him sleep upon her knees, and she called for a man, and she caused him to shave off the 7 locks of his head. And she began to afflict him, and his strength went from him. And she said, the Philistines be upon thee, Samson. And he awoke out of his sleep and said, I'll go out as other times as before and shake myself. And he wist not that Yahweh was departed from him. It's an incredibly sad scene. God has left him. And so the issue for Samson was his hair. That was the source of his strength. I don't know about you, but I've often wondered, why is it that his hair was the issue? If it was the Nazarite vow itself, he flaunted that ages ago. Remember, he went to that drinking feast. He was involved in all of that. That's his bucks party. Couldn't touch any wine. Couldn't eat grapes. He's walking through the vineyards when he ripped apart the lion. What about all the people that he'd actually killed? Now, Nazarites couldn't go near a dead body. I think Samson went near a dead body. Why was his strength not gone then? Why now? Is it because like it's the third thing to go? I don't think so. Let's go to Numbers chapter 6 because it gives us more of an insight. Numbers 6. The hair on the head of a Nazarite was there for a reason. And that reason was a symbol for all of Israel, that whoever saw this Nazarite, that this person is mimicking the high priest. Now, you could hide that you'd drunk alcohol or you'd eaten grapes. You could hide that you'd been near a dead body, not tell anyone. But if you had your head shaved and you were a Nazarite, everyone knew. The head of the Nazarite and the hair was an external indication to everyone of what was supposed to be going on internally. Choosing the right, shunning evil. Okay, Numbers chapter 6, verse 7. If you want a good book to reference with this, The Law of Moses by Brother Roberts. It's got a fantastic section of, I think, 10 pages or so, right on this very subject. It's very good. Anyway, verse 7. The issue with the Nazarite vow was not so much the not going near alcohol. It was not so much the not going near a dead body. The issue is all about the head and the hair that it is on the head. So verse 7, he shall not make himself unclean for his father, nor for his mother or brother or sister when they die. Okay, can't go near a dead body. Why? Because the consecration of his God is upon his head. All the days of his separation, he's holy unto Yahweh. If any man die near him very suddenly, and then he has defiled the head of his consecration. The Nazarite vow is all about those dreadlocks on the top of your head. That's what it was all about. And so for Samson to get rid of that was to defile his head. Now, what did the priest actually have on their head? They had a mitre, didn't they? So the Nazarite would actually wind their dreadlocks up into a bit of a turban. What did the high priest actually have written on the mitre?
Holy to God.
Okay. Now, in those verses there, does it actually say holy to God? Verse 8. Look at that. All the days of his separation, he is holy unto Yahweh. Exactly the same as what's written on the mitre of the high priest's turban. So when people were to see the Nazarite, they actually saw the high priest, as it were. And anyone could be part of that. Anyone in Israel, it doesn't say command Israel to do this, speak to Israel. So anyone, men, women, could be part of this vow. They could take that on. And so for Samson to say, you know what? He's taking the turban off. It's for him to say, I don't want to be part of that anymore. Which is terrible. And that's the reason why I think God left him. Not because of that's the last thing left of the vow, but because of what the head and the hair actually represents. So it's pretty terrible. But there's a way back. And we'll see that on Sunday, God willing. But at this point, he hasn't dealt with his problems. Verse 21. Not of Judges chapter 16, sorry. The Philistines took him. They put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza, bound him with fetters of brass, and he did grind in the prison house. Howbeit, the hair of his head began to grow again after he was shaven, and he took on that Nazarite vow once again. But this time, he really, really meant it. God sent him to the mill to deal with his pride, grinding day after day after day. He had his eyes plucked out to deal with the lust of the eye. That's what God needed. That's what God needed of Samson, to take action in his life for the problems that he had. Because Samson didn't take them for himself, to get rid of those temptations. And so Samson takes that vow again. And that's like all of us. We all fall short. We all have temptations. But for all of us, there's always a way back, every single time. So for me, the story of Samson, which we'll finish on Sunday, is extremely encouraging, because I've seen Samson, us, in all its rawness. We all have temptations, we all fall short, but there's always a way back. And I think that's a pretty special thing. So we might leave it there, and we'll finish it off on Sunday morning.